Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. An unidentified child was rescued in the Indian Ocean today after a passenger jet crashed while trying to land at the island nation of Comoros off East Africa. 153 passengers and crew were on board. The plane, a 19-year-old Airbus A310 with the airline Yemenia, crashed just before 2 a.m. local time, reportedly in bad weather. The plane took off from Yemen last night, but the flight originated in France. Joining us on the line from Paris is Nicola Clark. She's the aviation and transportation reporter for the International Herald Tribune. And Nicola, we understand there were some questions raised about this plane, this Airbus A310, when it was inspected by French officials in 2007.
Yes, it was. And the French Transport Minister, Dominique Bussereau, said today that that particular plane had been inspected and the French inspectors had noticed a certain number of what he said were faults without going into any detail. We don't know if they were corrected in that particular aircraft. But this is a plane that the Yemeni transport minister said today had just passed a safety inspection in Yemen under the supervision of Airbus experts. And he said that it was a comprehensive inspection and that it was in line with international standards. But this particular airline did undergo a safety audit by the International Air Transport Association. About a year ago, they received a safety certification from the IATA last July. Around about that same time, the airline also received an audit by the European Union Air Safety Committee that found some issues that they asked the airline to address. Again, we don't know what those were, but the airline did apparently address them and was spared any sort of action from the European Union air safety authorities. The European Union does have the authority to blacklist airlines that it deems unsafe from EU airspace.
So the European Union had considered putting Yemenia on this international airline blacklist, but did not do it.
They reviewed them. We don't know how seriously the possibility of them being blacklisted was. Today, the European Union Transport Commissioner said in a briefing that in the wake of this accident that they were going to be going back to the airline asking for more details about the safety record of the plane in question, which was 19 years old, as well as the rest of the airline's fleet, which includes 10 jets of Boeings and Airbuses.
So basically, in this particular case anyway, the focus is really on the airline, not necessarily on a 19-year-old Airbus plane.
That's correct. I mean, at this point, we have so little details about what brought this aircraft down. I guess we'll have to wait to see if they are able to recover the black boxes. That will obviously give them a lot of clues.
Now, this is the second major Airbus crash this month. The first was that flight that was going from Rio de Janeiro to Paris. And a report is expected out very soon on that particular crash. Any ideas, Nicola, of what might be in that report?
The French Air Accident Investigator is going to be publishing what they are calling a factual report on Thursday. It's expected to be primarily a summation of all of the facts that they have been able to gather from their investigation thus far. I think it would be very difficult to draw any links between these two accidents. These are two completely different aircraft. The only thing that these two have in common is they were flights. One was flying into France, the other was flying out of France, and the manufacturer of the airplane was Airbus. But I think, you know, you have to remember that there really are only two major manufacturers of large commercial aircraft in the world. It's Boeing and Airbus, and you know, I wouldn't think that anyone could draw any conclusions about the safety of Airbus aircraft based on the unfortunate fact that these two accidents have come so close together.
All right. Nicola Clark, aviation and transportation reporter for the International Herald Tribune, is speaking with us from Paris. Nicola, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We want to update you now on a story we first brought to you 2 years ago when immigration officials raided a factory in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Prosecutors then described it as a 19th century sweatshop. It was owned by the Michael Bianco Company, and its workers made backpacks for the U.S. military. More than 360 undocumented workers were arrested in the 2007 raid, which was one of several high-profile immigration raids that were taking place around the country. In New Bedford, many of those arrested were Central American women whose children were left stranded. 2 years later, most of those arrested are still in legal limbo, and Alliant Tech Systems, the Minnesota defense company known as ATK that bought the New Bedford factory a few months ago, recently announced plans to close it and move operations to Puerto Rico, where it already has a factory making those backpacks. 100 New Bedford workers have been laid off in the past few days, and our next guests are trying to stop the factory from closing. Joining us first on the line are Steve Wishart. He's a coordinator for Workers United, the union that's hoping to organize workers at the New Bedford factory. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, and also with us is Elisa Rios. She's a native of Puerto Rico, and she's been working legally at the factory since she was hired after the raid in 2007, and Elisa is in favor of a union there. Hello, Elisa.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Both of you went to Washington to meet with members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation to talk with them about the closure of this factory and try to get them to help you persuade the company to change its mind. Are you encouraged by what happened in Washington?
Yes, definitely. And I should say both the senators, Kerry and Kennedy, and Congressman Barney Frank, have been working with us when ATK announced they would close the factory. They have been very supportive from the beginning of stopping them from leaving New Bedford.
Now, obviously, there were a lot of high-profile abuses alleged at Michael Bianco after the immigration raid there in 2007. Did Alliant Tech Systems help with that, Steve?
Well, Alliant Tech Systems only bought the company a little over 3 months ago now. We had hoped that they would come in and continue to be a good employer, but they really made no changes and simply just announced that they were going to close the factory.
Mm-hmm. But Eagle Industries, which Alliant Tech Systems is the parent company, they were the first ones who came in and took over the factory, and they did make some improvements in conditions for workers. Isn't that right?
They made some cosmetic changes. The majority of the workers here were only being paid the state minimum wage. There was only 32 employees of the factory that even participated in the company's health plan. There was no retirement plan at all. The company did institute a 401k, but it had no match. And the other issue was health and safety issues in the plant. OSHA has recently been in there doing an investigation the last couple months, and we expect that they're going to be issuing a number of violations and citations on the company here shortly.
Mm. And, Elisa, I'd like to ask you, what is it like working there right now?
A sadness. How ATK management laughing and proud closed the door for us.
And what about in terms of overall at the plant itself? Have there been some gradual improvements that you've seen since 2007 or no?
No.
None. Have you seen it get worse?
It's more worse and worse. I think that's not right from the person who have a contract for the government.
Now, the folks who run Alliant Technology have said that the factory in New Bedford is underutilized and there are not enough backpacks being produced there. Is there not enough business?
That's not true because we work hard. We work 7:30 in the morning to 6 p.m. almost every day, Monday to Thursday. I do the hand grenade, and they ask me 500 every day, and I do make my 500 every day.
The company's line that there's excess capacity and not enough work is really astonishing to me because the workers have been working overtime there for the past couple weeks. And basically they want to take the contract and these jobs and send them to Puerto Rico and hire 350 new workers there. This is a profitable company. The CEO made $9 million last year. They're making a profit on this contract already. And the only reason they want to shift the work to Puerto Rico is that so they can squeeze a few more dollars out of this contract and make a little more profit. There's more than enough work to keep these workers in New Bedford working.
Hmm. And so have you appealed to the U.S. military as well?
Yes, we have appealed to the U.S. Army to step in and deny the company the modification of the contract to move the work to Puerto Rico and also not to renew the next upcoming year of the contract unless the work is going to be done in New Bedford.
Can the Army do that? Can they decide not to renew? I mean, is that even possible?
Yes, it is. To move the whole contract to Puerto Rico, they still have to get the Army's approval to do that.
And there are some folks, though, who have accused you and the union of pushing the new owners toward closing the factory.
Well, you know, if the company is moving away to avoid the union, then they're violating the federal law. And once again, you know, the Army, the federal government should not do business with a company that would do such actions.
I'd like to thank both of you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We want to turn now to Brian Cullen. He's a spokesman for factory owner ATK. Brian, your thoughts on what Steve and Elisa have told us?
First of all, I want to say that it was hard to recognize our company with a lot of the things that were said. And I'd also want to say that, you know, there's never a good time for a company to reduce its force, and certainly this is not any exception during these times. I'd also have to agree with Elisa. One thing that she did say is that they worked hard at New Bedford. And they do work hard at New Bedford. It's a great workforce. They've been doing a good job at the work. The problem is there is no longer the kind of work that there had been previously, and that this was a business decision, a tough business decision we had to make to close the facility down. And it's much less of an issue of the workforce itself, but more of the excess facilities that in actually doing the work.
Elisa said that she has a lot of work and she makes 500 backpacks a day. Is that a lower number than what had been required of many stitchers at the factories?
No, actually, there has been a lot of work at the facility historically up until, when ATK took a look at Eagle Industries quite a few months ago now. We purchased it back in March. Before we did the actual acquisition of the company, we took a look at the workload. And we made a decision at that time that there were too many facilities based on the current contracts with the Army and law enforcement to keep New Bedford open. But there has been work. One thing I would disagree with, though, there has not, since ATK has owned the company, there has not been any overtime done to work through the present contract.
And you knew before you bought this facility in New Bedford that you were likely going to have to shut it down because of the number of facilities you would then have acquired and the amount of work stipulated in those Army contracts.
That's correct. I'd also have to say there was a mention at the very beginning of your show that we were moving 300 jobs to Puerto Rico. The facility that Eagle has in Puerto Rico, as well as the one in Missouri, both of those are certified facilities, and that facility in Puerto Rico was doing the same work as New Bedford, so it's not a question of shifting jobs down to Puerto Rico. It is a facility that we had operating in Puerto Rico that was certified by the U.S. Army.
So there won't be any additional jobs in Puerto Rico then if you move the work down there?
Based on the current load, there won't be.
Brian Cullen is a spokesman for New Bedford factory owner ATK. He'll be back with us in a minute, and we'll ask him why his company has decided to make this move to Puerto Rico. We'll also hear from a priest in New Bedford about reaction among his parishioners to the planned factory closing. And coming up later in the show, as a military coup rocks Honduras, we'll look at what it means for Central America. Back after a break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're discussing a military apparel factory in New Bedford, Massachusetts, which its new owner is planning to shut down, so production of the military apparel can be consolidated in Puerto Rico. Brian Cullen is spokesman for the factory owner ATK, Alliant Tech Systems. And Brian, is the company interested in moving production to Puerto Rico because workers at the New Bedford factory are talking about forming a union?
We are a company with about 10% of our workforce is union, and we're in 22 states of the country and now Puerto Rico as well. So this has absolutely not been an issue for us to make this business decision. It had nothing to do with organizing labor.
Why move to Puerto Rico?
Well, Puerto Rico has been a very productive facility that we've had there. So this is, again, a business decision based on the kind of contract load that we have.
Mm-hmm. Is it because of lower wages for the workers, which is what many people probably automatically expect is the reason when they hear that you're moving somewhere outside of the continental U.S.? Is that accurate?
Well, I don't believe it's accurate. It's much, it's not a question of the cost of labor. It's much more a question of the excess infrastructure and excess facilities. We just couldn't afford to have more facilities than we had work.
What about the claim from Steve Wishart that the CEO of the company made $9 million last year?
Well, what he didn't mention is my CEO took a 14% decrease in his salary based on the current economic situation. So, we could talk at length about the income of CEOs in the aerospace and defense industry, but I don't think it's relevant to the point about New Bedford.
Hmm. He also said, though, that the original contract with Alliant stipulates that those backpacks that number of backpacks be made in New Bedford. Is that something that's going to be difficult for you to work with in your plans to shift to the facility in Puerto Rico?
Well, I think the best way to answer that is everything that we do must be in compliance with the contract that we have with the Army. And we are in compliance with our contract with the Army. We have a certified facility in Puerto Rico that was already making the load-bearing packs that are currently being made under the contract. So we're in compliance with that contract.
And so, therefore, you do or do not need a U.S. Army approval to make this shift?
We do not believe we do.
Any tax breaks for shifting to Puerto Rico or no?
I don't believe so, but, each state has its own incentives.
Are there any other facilities that you're thinking about doing something similar with?
I don't believe so, not at this time.
All right. Well, Brian, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Deb.
Well, for another perspective on this story, we turn to Father Richard Wilson, pastor at St. James Roman Catholic Church in New Bedford. And Father Wilson, we know that Elisa Rios, who we heard earlier in this show and who works at the ATK facility, is one of your parishioners. But not everyone in New Bedford feels the same way she does about the union at this facility. And this issue's been divisive. Can you explain the reaction among many of your parishioners about ATK's decision to move operations to Puerto Rico?
Well, I think people are sad about it, and they would like the company to remain here because of the impact that it would have on our local economy to have that number of people lose their jobs, a lot of whom are paying mortgages. So, in our church basement, we've had a few meetings between public officials and the employees about trying to keep the jobs here in the city. We had already dealt with the immigration raid at the factory a few years ago, which also had a great impact on our parish, since a lot of those people were from the parish, too. They were from Central America. Now these are parishioners who are Puerto Rican or Portuguese Americans who might be losing their jobs, and they have an even greater kind of stake in the community. And so to have them all be out of work would in some ways cause even more disruption than the immigration raid did.
What about some of the folks from that raid? There were 361 undocumented workers arrested in that raid, and it's our understanding that only about a handful of those cases really have been resolved. What's happening with many of those workers? Are they still around and still members of your parish?
A lot still are here in New Bedford and are members of the parish, and a lot of them are working their way through the immigration court system. A few people have been given work permission, but most have not been, so it puts one in a very precarious situation economically.
Now, the company says this is a business decision. Is there a feeling at all that some folks might be saying, well, that's the way it works sometimes, and businesses leave communities, and there's really not much we can do about it?
I mean, I have heard people say that, and there's no denying that people in Puerto Rico need jobs, too. It's not as if the economy there is great, but it's ironic that the people here, a lot of whom will be losing their jobs, are also from Puerto Rico. I mean, we continue to have people moved to New Bedford from Puerto Rico.
In New Bedford, Massachusetts is already a city that's in decline and has been in decline for some time now. So I imagine that losing these jobs is another blow to the economy of New Bedford.
It is. I mean, we do see a lot of hopeful signs in the city, too. I wouldn't want to say that we're just a city in decline, but that industry of textiles has been declining over the last several decades, and in part because of the whole flow of companies do cheaper and cheaper labor, both first in the United States and then in other countries.
Father Richard Wilson is pastor of the St. James Roman Catholic Church in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Father Wilson, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, some of philosopher Ayn Rand's followers are having second thoughts about her philosophy of unfettered free markets, but the bad economy has also led to a spike in sales of her books. At one point, she was outselling President Obama's Audacity of Hope. Also, grilling. It's not just an American thing anymore. Our resident chef goes global with barbecue tips from Mexico to Vietnam. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, she played Tara the Witch on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. 6 years after Buffy went off the air, Amber Benson is back with a new fantasy book that has something in common with the TV show, a feminine hero. We'll be back after the news, Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ponzi scheme mastermind Bernard Madoff may get some company in prison. The Associated Press reports that federal authorities are investigating at least 10 of his associates to determine if they played a role in the multi-billion-dollar scheme. Madoff was sentenced to 150 years in prison yesterday, and the question now is, where will he do his time? Newsweek reports that Madoff has hired a prison consultant to help him get placed in a better facility. And to find out more about how this works, we're joined by John Webster. He's Managing Director of National Prison and Sentencing Consultants. He became a consultant after serving 13 months in prison himself. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
If Bernard Madoff was your client, what would you do to try to get him in a better facility?
The first thing we would try to do is to get what is known as a public safety factor waived, because the Bureau of Prisons regulations require that a male sentenced to greater than 30 years be placed in a high-security prison, meaning a United States penitentiary. So that would be our first line of attack. High-security facilities, United States penitentiaries, they're very unpleasant. They are populated by people with a significant history of violent activity. His health and life may be at risk.
But John, some people might be listening, and you know what they might be saying, you know, sentences aren't supposed to be pleasant.
Yes, but you know what? This crime was not eligible for the death sentence. So I believe what you can't do by direction, you can't do by indirection. And I think for a person like Mr. Madoff, being in a high-security U.S. penitentiary would be creating a significant risk to his health and well-being.
Couldn't you say that for most of the inmates there, though?
Yes, I do. I mean, I can. However, many of the inmates that are there have a significant history of violence themselves.
Well, let's talk about that determination as to what type of level of secure facility inmates do go to. Primarily, this is determined by the Federal Bureau of Prisons by a form, really, that tallies a security risk of an inmate. Tell us how important this form is and this numerical rating of an inmate is when the Federal Bureau of Prisons does make a determination about what type of facility an inmate goes to.
Sure. Generally, it's a very important process. And to be able to get into, say, a minimum security facility, a federal prison camp, he needs to score under 11 based upon certain factors: age, nature of crime, education, drug use, history of violence, escapes. There's 14 different categories the Bureau looks at. He scores a level 5, so he would technically be eligible for a camp. Mm. However, the Bureau certainly does factor in what's called your months to release, which for him is 1,800. Under the regulations, he would end up in a high-security facility.
So when you advise clients about how to get into a better facility, how do you define better?
The first thing I worry about is what I like to call safety first. Get them in the lowest security facility they would be eligible for. Number two, I look at programming, whether or not they may be eligible for the drug and alcohol program, which can also reduce their time. Then the third is ease of visitation for the family members.
How much does it cost someone to have you advise them about what type of facility they might end up serving their sentence in?
I charge $3,500 for designation and prison preparation work. If my client wants me to travel, and some do, it's $3,500 plus $2,500 per day.
There may be some people who might think that basically your services are a way for people to buy their way into a better prison.
I'm sorry they would think that. It's not really buying, because, you know, I have to use, you know, my knowledge of the system, my expertise, you know, and advocate with the Bureau of Prisons. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So we've never viewed it as somebody buying themselves a better prison. And I'm sorry that people would think that way.
What do you think is going to happen to Mr. Madoff in prison?
Well, wherever he goes, I think he's going to be in isolation for a while. The Bureau certainly doesn't want to be or put him at risk. I mean, that's the last thing the Bureau needs, is to have Mr. Madoff, you know, injured or assaulted in prison. You know, let's not forget that, you know, inmates watch TV. They read the newspapers. They read all of the same periodicals and journals that we read. They're very well aware of what Mr. Madoff did. And I would venture to guess that many of the inmates know somebody who've been injured by Mr. Madoff, and they're not going to be happy with him. Many of his clients were elderly. Next to being a sex offender, people who rob the elderly are the least favored people in prison.
So you think he's going to be assaulted?
Let's put it this way. He's going to be playing a lot of solitaire. He's not going to have a lot of friends.
John Webster helps negotiate prison placements for convicted criminals. He's managing director of National Prison and Sentencing Consultants. John, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, John.
And we'll be back in just 30 seconds. It's Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. It used to be fairly common to hear of a military coup taking power in a Central American nation, but Sunday's move against Honduran President Manuel Zelaya was the first military power grab since the brief failed effort to oust Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez in 2002. Zelaya was still in his pajamas Sunday when the military forced him on a plane to Costa Rica. That sparked confrontations in the street of Tegucigalpa with police firing tear gas at demonstrators. Backed by other governments in the region and the Obama administration, Zelaya says he'll come home this week. But the new Honduran government says he'll be arrested if he does. The BBC's Mexico City correspondent Stephen Gibbs joins us from Tegucigalpa now. And Stephen, the new government says this was not a coup. So why was Zelaya pulled from power?
Well, President Zelaya had been in power here for 4 years, and he was really elected as pretty much a centrist politician. But during his tenure here, he's drifted pretty much to the left, and many of the particularly powerful groups here were worried about that. They were worried that he was getting very close to President Chavez of Venezuela, and they were particularly concerned, and in many ways they thought that all their bad predictions were coming true when he announced a few months ago that he planned to alter the Constitution, and they thought that that was really him attempting to change the Constitution in order that he could stay in power longer.
So who is in power right now?
Well, I mean, officially, the interim president is a gentleman called Roberto Micheletti. Now, he was the Speaker of the Congress, and according to the Constitution, if the President is not around or is removed, then the Speaker takes over. But one can't help wondering who is behind all this. Maybe Roberto Micheletti is really the front man, and they're effectively some kingmakers behind him. And you have to bear in mind that there are wealthy elites, there are powerful groups within Honduras who can control and pull the strings to a certain extent.
Now, you mentioned wealthy and powerful interests in Honduras. Would you say that they are the folks pulling the strings here in Mr. Zelaya's ouster?
We should bear in mind that President Zelaya was not a particularly popular president. He, in the last few months, his popularity was around 30%. So there are quite a few people here in Honduras who feel this is all somewhat misunderstood and is being stirred up by people outside the country. I spoke to one man who was looking on a bit bemused as some of these pro-Zelaya protesters were causing a bit of damage and taunting the soldiers, and he felt really that the current administration had failed to properly explain why they had taken power.
I am worried. I believe that Honduras has the capability of handling this situation internally, but what I'm really worried about is that an international crisis might be a result of this problem right now.
So, Stephen, that man that you spoke with, he's actually concerned that there are outside forces at work in Honduras. What is he saying? Is he saying that someone, say, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is having undue influence here, or others might be?
Yes, I mean, Honduras is, as you can imagine, this is a pretty tense situation here, and it's completely awash with rumors. And most people you speak to in Honduras, you say, how do you think this is going to turn out? And really, from whatever background they're from, they say, well, people are talking about a war, a military intervention by Chavez. He's being portrayed as the great bogeyman by the people in charge here. And there's no question that Hugo Chavez from outside the country is making some pretty strong statements. He's talking of overthrowing the government here. Now, he does use that sort of language quite a lot, so one has to bear that in mind. But no, behind all this, there's a feeling and a worry of Hondurans, really from both sides of the political spectrum, that their future is being tampered with by people from outside the country.
And was that a primary concern, do you think, by the folks who wanted to overtake Zelaya in the first place? And I'm wondering, if it was, did this overtaking of power almost backfire in a way?
Yes, I mean, I think there's no question that Zelaya's fate was sealed because he was getting extremely close to Hugo Chavez. He was bringing the country much closer, and then he was apparently mimicking Hugo Chavez by attempting to change the constitution. So that was the big problem, and that is why the people in power here felt that they had to move. But sitting here, it does seem that they might well have mistimed it, that bearing in mind that President Zelaya was not particularly popular, bearing in mind he only had 6 months left of his presidency, do they really think that he was going to be able to change the constitution and stay in power for a long time, or could they have just sat back and let this play out and probably found that he was voted out and they had a new president by the end of the year?
And of course, also now you have Hugo Chavez saying that he's working furiously to protect democracy in Honduras. So is that something that perhaps was also a miscalculation on the part of the folks who have taken over in Honduras?
Yes, I mean, I think this has escalated way out of their control, particularly with President Obama giving his very strong support, really, to President Zelaya. So, no, things have undoubtedly got out of control, really. I mean, what Hugo Chavez was saying was interesting, saying that we must support the Honduran people in their uprising, effectively. Now, on the ground here, you're not really seeing an uprising. You're seeing a very vociferous minority of people who believe that President Zelaya was removed illegally, but they are definitely a minority. Most Hondurans are sitting back and watching all this with a degree of disbelief.
Now, President Obama has said that this coup sets a terrible precedent. He's condemned it. But also, there are some accusations that the U.S. Should have seen this coming. Are there signs, or is it a common belief anyway, that the U.S. may have looked the other way?
I think the U.S. was in a very difficult situation given its history in Central America. In Honduras alone, between the 60s and the 80s, there were four military coups, and certainly some of them had at least tacit American support. There's no question that the United States administration saw this coming. Many, many people did see this coming. The Honduran military is actually trained by the U.S., so they're extremely close contacts. Now, what State Department officials are saying is that in the few days before this happened, they were in close contact with the military and they were effectively advising them to hold off. They were extremely worried about what might happen. And on the day of the coup, according to at least one State Department official, the phone calls from the U.S. military to the Hondurans were not responded to. They lost contact and the Hondurans went ahead.
Stephen Gibbs is the BBC's Mexico City correspondent, speaking with us from Tegucigalpa, Honduras. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
At this recent book signing at Pandemonium Books in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a long line of fans waited to see actor-turned-director and author Amber Benson. She was in town to promote her new book, Death's Daughter. It's the first of an urban fantasy trilogy about Calliope, a young woman who is literally the daughter of death and who has to try to save her father after he's kidnapped. But many of those waiting in line were there for another reason. For three seasons, Amber Benson was Tara McClay, the lesbian witch on the cult hit TV show Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa went to the signing and asked some of the fans waiting online why they liked the show.
It's just a really fun story. There's a lot of humor to it, but there's also a lot of, like, very serious life-changing stuff, like people die, people have to deal with loss, people have to deal with love, stuff like that.
Buffy is a really strong female character, and she's one of the few characters that I can idolize too. idolize up to, yeah.
I'm here because I was a big Buffy fan growing up, and I pretty much watched it from the beginning, and I really like Amber.
Anything in particular about Amber's character, or is it just that she was involved with Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
I consider myself gay, and so when I saw that there was strong, positive lesbian role models, I really connected with that. That was probably a big part of it.
More than 6 years after Buffy the Vampire Slayer went off the air, the show about the blonde teen who fights the forces of evil with her best friends Willow and Xander still seems to resonate. Emiko, who freely admits to being a Buffy fan, caught up with Amber Benson after the book signing to talk about the continuing appeal of Tara and Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
There are so many Buffy fans in the world. Everywhere I go, literally, like, I've been around the world, and every country there's somebody that comes over. Are you Tara from Buffy? I was in Los Angeles at a vintage clothing store, and two kids from Denmark stopped me and my friend, and they're like, are you Tara from Buffy? You made our vacation. So I took pictures with them, and they were so sweet, and then they Twittered about it.
Well, also, it's like, I was talking to some of the fans in line, and there's a very sort of emotional reaction some of them have, like, to your character.
Yeah, well, I think we were the first long-term lesbian relationship on national television, and I think a lot of people connected to those characters and felt like somebody was finally speaking for them, and there just hadn't been a role model before, you know, or role models.
Tara, I have to tell you.
No, I understand. You have to be with the person you love.
I am.
You mean?
I mean. Okay?
Oh, yes.
Staying on that for just one moment, what was really interesting about that was your character was killed off at the end of season 6. And Joss Whedon, the creator of Buffy, has been quoted as saying he had no idea of the magnitude of reaction that would get.
No, like he was really coming from a story point of view, and I don't think he realized how much he was going to kind of hurt the gay, lesbian, transgendered community. People were really devastated by it because they're like, you gave us these wonderful characters and then you just take them away. And I think they felt like it wasn't fair.
What was it like for you to sort of have that magnitude of reaction?
It was amazing. The letters and the emails and just people stopping me on the street. I cried when you died, and I'd stopped watching the show because you died. And I couldn't believe that this was a television show and people were taking it so personally. I didn't understand. As an actor, you're sort of in a bubble. You don't realize what impact you're having on people till you walk around on the street and you find out that you're touching people's lives.
And I want to talk to you about the transition that you have made. I mean, you're still acting, mm-hmm. but you're doing a lot more directing.
Yeah.
And, of course, you're writing, which is why we were all here tonight. Can you talk about sort of how you made that shift?
I feel like if you're a woman and you're in the entertainment industry and you have a brain, just being an actor isn't fulfilling enough. I mean, you really are a pawn in someone else's chess game. You are repeating other people's words. And I wanted to create my own words. I wanted to be in control of my own creative destiny. And by writing, you create the content. And by directing, you control how the content is released out into the world, you know? And I felt like I needed to kind of get in control of my creative existence.
Well, one thing that a number of the people said when in line tonight was that one of the things that appealed to them about Buffy the Vampire Slayer was strong female central characters. And that's one thing that we also see in your book. We have the central female character in a fantasy, which is not something that you see a lot in fantasy. Fantasy tends to be a lot centered around the male hero.
Well, I wanted, the reason I wrote the book is I wanted to see a female character go on a hero's quest. I love Joseph Campbell, the hero with 1,000 faces, and you have these characters going on heroes' journeys, and very rarely are they women. A lot of times with urban fantasy, you have women that are already in the situation, and they're already kick butt and ready to go out there and fight the world and, you know, fight all the bad things. Whereas, like with Buffy and hopefully with my character, Calliope, you have a flawed character who is fighting this supernatural destiny. They don't want to just beast, you know, this supernatural kick butt kind of, you know, vampire slayer or whatever, you know, whatever has been thrust on them. They want to be normal girls too, and they fight this battle between accepting the call to their destiny and being normal girls.
What's fun about her, of course, and you talked about this tonight, you sort of referred to it semi-disparagingly as a bit of a chick-lit book, because the truth is Calliope will notice someone's shoes on the way to her quest.
Yes, in fact, I know I had to do more research about fashion than I did about myth and religion, because that's stuff that I'm interested in. I'm like, Marc Jacobs? What's a Marc Jacobs? but yeah, she's a girly girl, and it's written in the first person, so you get this stream of consciousness, so you hear like all the stupid stuff that she thinks and the comments she makes to herself, you know, you get really involved in her kind of girly world. And I wanted her to be flawed. I wanted her to be a little self-involved, because over the arc of the trilogy, she kind of finds herself and accepts her destiny.
I'm wondering, because, you know, you have this other career, but you're still not divorcing yourself completely from the idea of acting.
No, acting still is helping to pay the bills. And I really enjoy acting. I've just been doing a couple of web series, and I did an episode of Private Practice. But mostly, like, I want to create my own stuff. Like, my boyfriend, Adam Bush, who played Warren on Buffy, he and I just co-directed a film called Drones. And we had a ball. Like, it's a little indie thing. It's going to be going to festivals. And we just had so much fun doing it. I really enjoyed sort of creating a universe that wasn't just on paper, that was real, that you could see and hear. And if not touch, you know, you could be touched by it emotionally.
And, you know, it was a wonderful series, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But it was 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. However, you know, you are Amber Benson, who wasn't Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Is there a part of you that goes, can I drop that line from my resume now?
You know, I have so much gratitude toward Joss Whedon for giving me the opportunity to be on the show, because it opened doors that wouldn't have been opened otherwise. So, yeah, sometimes I'm like, well, I'm doing other things, but I'm happy to be Tara McClay from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. If people won't call me Tara, I'm Tara, you know? I own it and love it.
I live my life in shadow, never the sun on my face.
Actor, director, and author Amber Benson's new book is Death's Daughter. And this is Amber Benson, by the way, singing as Tara McClay in Buffy the Vampire Slayer's musical episode. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. Robin Young returns tomorrow. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again here and now.
It's magic, I can tell how you set me free, brought me out so easily. I saw